The following is an encore episode of Hour 1 of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into the frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Good morning and welcome to this Wednesday edition of the Turley Frequency. Today on the show we meet a relic hunter extraordinaire, that is Sean Pilcher, who will be explaining to us the meaning and importance of relics in our 21st century world. We speak to Sean in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open right now. In the final segment today, we meet author and academic Chris Rice, who has just published a new book on a global and personal renewal in a post-pandemic world. Sounds good. Going to have to stick around to the last segment to find out more. Okay, with all that good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Yes, I hope your Wednesday morning is going well, wherever you are, wherever you're listening to us. Now, there is so much in the news at the moment that I don't know where to start. I was listening to the news last night, and it was full of American news this side of the Atlantic because Donald J. Trump, as you all know, appeared in court yesterday. And Donald, whatever you might think of him politically, boy, is he big box office. Wherever he goes, whatever he does, he makes the headlines. And there's absolutely no dispute on that. You will never have a recount when it comes to box office and Donald J. Trump. He is making the headlines. But is he making the right headlines? There is all the stuff, which I'm not a lawyer. I haven't read the indictment. I'm not sure what it's all about sometimes. I mean, the Espionage Act is not something most people discuss in the United States, let alone the United Kingdom. So we'll see what happens in court. The wider implications, the political fallout, of course, that is of perhaps greater interest because Donald J. Trump is still the front runner for the Republican nominee for the 2024 presidential election. So we've got the Republicans possibly campaigning from a prison cell, and we've got Joe Biden campaigning from another cell, probably a basement somewhere underneath the White House. I mean, this is a man who, just to balance things out, because we've had Trump in court and all of that, well, we've had Biden falling right, left and center. Every time he appears in public, he seems to fall over. I mean, if I was 80, and I'm speaking to you straight, Joe, here, I'm speaking to you man to man. If I was 80 years old, I would be beside a beach with one of those nice ice creams that you like. And I would be enjoying the sunshine, the fresh air, and the lapping waves. I would not be sitting in the White House trying to sort out the national debt, trying to run the free world, trying to offset the Chinese infiltration of every single aspect of the United States and Western society. I don't think I would have the energy for it at 80. In fact, Joe, do you know what? At my age, and I'm a lot younger than you, I don't have the energy for it. So I don't know what sort of ice cream you're eating, but keep eating it because you've obviously got a better appetite than I have for all of life's complexities. But seriously, is that really where we're up to? somebody who may be eating prison food and somebody who may be eating ice cream, but he doesn't know which flavor it is. Is that really the choice that the American people are going to be facing in the coming year? Well, I'm not an American, is all I can say, and thank you, Lord. Maybe somebody good will come out of the woodwork. Some good will come out of this. We'll have to get Mike Church back on the show and have his latest take on all these shenanigans. But we've had a lot of it this side as well in the last few days. Perhaps you haven't heard as much about it. I know British news doesn't play as loudly sometimes in the United States, but Boris Johnson is our sort of equivalent of Donald Trump in the sense that he just can't leave the headlines alone. And to be honest, the headline writers can't leave him alone. Boris Johnson is to the British press what Donald J. Trump is to the United States media. They love him and they hate him, and they hate him because they love him, because everything that Boris does makes headlines, grabs news, devours inches of columns which are either lambasting him or praising him in equal measure. And all I will say is that there's the similarities between Trump and Boris Johnson are essentially that they were both celebrities before they became politicians. And that's something to bear in mind. And maybe it's a warning. Maybe it's a warning. Maybe we don't want our politicians to be such celebrities. I mean, what you're voting for next year, what we will be voting for in a general election probably next year as well, we're not voting for a reality game show. We're not voting for some reality game show where the winner gets to run the country for a short period of time. That's not really the Catholic understanding of what politics, civil society, how it should be ordered. The common good that we often hear about from Catholic social teaching. It's not a game show, guys. It is not a reality TV show where the winner wins and the loser gets told off by the advancing party. No. Donald and Boris, you got to learn this is not TV. This is the real world. And real politics impacts on real people, as we know. There's been a large debate in this country in the last years about the crumbling health service that we live in here. It's virtually impossible to get hold of a doctor to see you. I mean, it's quite frightening in a sense. Now, that's because we have something called the National Health Service, which is a kind of socialized medicine. We all pay for it out of our taxes, but it doesn't work. It's not working at the moment. And I say that without any party political angle. I mean, I have a lot of relatives who work in the National Health Service, and they tell me it doesn't work. It's not working. Doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, because the system doesn't work. So these sorts of things are real politics. These are things that really need attending to, as opposed to the pantomime that seems to have taken on both United States politics and to some extent British politics at the moment, where it's personality driven. And we love gossip, we love scandal, we love intrigue. But actually, I'm old enough to remember a time when politics didn't really have any of that, or not overtly anyway. Of course, it's always been part of the political world. But when I was growing up, politicians were rather sober figures. I'm sure they were for you. They were figures who came in with a sense of public duty, that wanted to change the society that we live in for better. Right? They came with an agenda. They came feeling that there were things that they wanted to do. Now, judging from the comments from Donald J. Trump last night, what he wants to do when he gets in, if he ever gets reelected again, is to get even with the, quotes, thugs that have taken him to court. So, I mean, that's not exactly a policy agenda that people are going to run out and vote for, I don't think. But Boris Johnson is the same. Boris Johnson is the same. Boris Johnson has threatened to come back to politics and has talked about a witch hunt and about how people have all ganged up against him and removed him, a legitimately elected prime minister, etc., etc. It's all about him, just as it's all about Donald. And to some extent, it's all about Joe. If Joe knew who he was half time, it would be all about him as well. There's one word that comes to mind when I think of the political swamps both sides of the Atlantic. I wonder if you can guess what that word is. It begins with H. It is the word hubris. It's not a word that's used a lot these days, but I love it as a word. It's one of those words that sort of rolls off the tongue. And there's a sort of a sound to it, mate, which gives it some idea of its meaning. Because hubris comes from the ancient Greek, as so many of our words do, and it means a sort of pride, a sort of insolence, coupled with a kind of an outrage. And it describes, if you like, not just a situation, but more a personality and a personality defect in a sense. Because it's a personality who is got an extreme or an excessive form of pride, which gives them a dangerous overconfidence. I wonder who that describes. A personality with a quality of extreme or excessive pride with a dangerous overconfidence. That could be on the job description for most of our world leaders at the moment, I'm afraid, that they must have this quality because they all seem to have it. Then it's not just an Anglosphere problem. I mean, we've got Emmanuel Macron in France. This is a very small man who married his teacher and now runs France. I mean, it just couldn't get any more laughable. The world has gone very, very strange. There are some good leaders out there. There are new leaders emerging. For example, the woman who's running Italy at the moment seems to be a very sensible woman with some very, very Catholic views on the economy and how to change society. But anyway, back to those that we are burdened with, the hubris of the politicians that surround us. Now, one of the characteristics or one of the aspects of hubris is that it is often not assigned to a group. So we don't talk of a nation as being hubris or even a political party as having hubris. It is very much an individual characteristic. It's kind of like a fault. Just in the same way that we don't talk about a paranoid nation or a schizophrenic nation or a delusional nation, we talk about individuals who have these traits. Well, hubris is a trait which is very much ascribed to an individual. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to ascribe it to many, many politicians. The Old Testament, as we were talking about the other day in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18, there's a word in the Hebrew which is very akin to the word hubris in English or in Greek. And it pops up in that verse, and it's something we've already talked about. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Well, the haughty spirit bit is the hubris. It's that overbearing confidence, that overbearing pride in one's own ability. And it's very, very dangerous. Now, why am I talking about this? Well, we are in the run-up to the Feast of the Sacred Heart, you remember? And last week we looked at a lot at pride and arrogance and how these things, pride and vanity, sorry, how these things are the direct opposite to the things that we should be dwelling on this week and very much the heart of Christ. Remember verse Matthew chapter 11, come to me all you that are laboring and overburdened and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon yourselves and learn from me. I am gentle and humble of heart. And then it goes on to say in that verse, and you shall find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, put that in direct contrast to everything we have said before. Take my yoke upon yourselves. Take my yoke upon yourselves. I'm afraid so many of our politicians, they build their own yokes and they put them around their own necks and their hearts are very disturbed and distracted, full of hubris, full of pride, full of arrogance. And they have no rest. They have no rest. I mean, one of the reasons, I was only half joking when I said I'd be sitting by the beach instead of sitting in the White House if I were Joe Biden. But part of the problem is the appetite, the addiction to these type of situations, to power. I mean, even Donald Trump is not a young man. I mean, he's in his mid to late 70s. I mean, surely, Donald, you've already been president. You've had enough. You could have had a quiet life. Why don't you have a quiet life? Ever asked yourself that? Why do people not have a quiet life? I asked my wife that the other day and she gave a really, really good answer. I said, why don't these people just go and sit somewhere and, you know, enjoy their money, enjoy their time, enjoy whatever they've done? And she said, Kevin, to do that, they would have to have peace of heart. I thought that was a really, really interesting insight. You see, you and I, we have peace of heart. Because no matter what difficulties we're surrounded by, we have the peace of Christ, the Prince of Peace, abiding in our hearts through the state of grace, hopefully, that we're all in. And if you're not in, go to confession, get in it. Or ask the Lord for it and then go to confession. But what I'm trying to say is that our faith is a rock, an anchor. We've talked about this before, which gives us hope, but it also gives us peace, something the world desperately wants and needs. Now, we're coming up to the Feast of the Sacred Heart on Friday, closely followed by the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as the week progresses. But I went back and looked at the famous consecration of the world to the Sacred Heart. Now, do you remember we were telling the story of Blessed Mary of the Divine Heart? Do you remember? Blessed Mary of the Divine Heart. Now, she was the nun, the German nun, who at the end of the 19th century decided or had visions of our Lord in her monastery in Portugal. Do you remember in the story so far, she had taken vows in Germany, but she worked for a number of years with the Good Shepherd sisters there, but then she was moved to become a superior in the convent in Porto in Portugal. And it was there that she had a number of visions of our Lord and of His Sacred Heart. And she communicated these to her confessor, who wrote to the Pope. And what the visions were saying to Sister Mary was that he wanted his heart, he wanted the world consecrated to his Sacred Heart, to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And believe it or not, the confessor wrote to the Pope, and in due course, a year or so later, that consecration did in fact take place. And I sat down last night and read the document that the Pope created for that in announcing what this consecration is, because it's one of those things which is kind of interesting to look at. Because I don't know about you, I mean, are you clear what a consecration to the Sacred Heart means? No, I wasn't either. So I went and looked that up, and basically it's a kind of complete surrender of ourselves, our lives, our wills, our difficulties, our sufferings, our whole lives to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And it's a kind of an act of total trust in God and his ability to look after us and take care of us. And what Pope Leo XIII was doing when he was consecrating the world to the Sacred Heart was just that. It was entrusting the world to the Sacred Heart, that somehow the Sacred Heart would rule, his love, his kingship would rule throughout the world. Now, some of the interesting features of that document is, first of all, the Pope did something which was a bit unusual in that he consecrated the whole world. He didn't just consecrate the Catholic world. He didn't just consecrate you and me to the Sacred Heart. He consecrated everybody. And the reason was very, very clear. Because he says that it was an act of charity. Why should non-Catholics miss out on this wonderful consecration to the Sacred Heart? Why shouldn't they benefit from being consecrated to the Sacred Heart of Jesus? It's very interesting. But it also took place at the start of the 20th century. And Pope Leo XIII was very, very keen to consecrate this new century to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And indeed, the document by which he was talking about this also promulgated a holy year at the start of this century. So the Pope was very clear that there was a need for a spiritual, if you like, a reconsecration, a rebirth, if you like, a revival of our understanding of God's love for us in the coming century. Now, for all of us who lived through part of that century and certainly know the history of that century, that consecration was never more needed. And before you say, well, a lot of good that did, given all the wars and all the other problems of the 20th century, my reply is very simple. Just think how worse it could have been without that consecration. Now, I was going to talk some more about this document and our consecration, but we've got tomorrow and we've got Friday as well in the run-up to the Sacred Heart. But I just want to leave you with one thought. The consecration to the Sacred Heart of Jesus was promulgated. The document was sent out on 18, Let me just get this right. 1899, and it was on the 25th of May. Right? 25th of May. Did you know that on the 25th of May, 1898, therefore a year earlier, the first photograph was taken of the Shroud of Turin? Yes, that Shroud of Turin. That was the night that the photographer, a man called Pia, stood in his dark room and saw this amazing photographic image of a crucified Christ. My question to you this morning, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but is it a coincidence at the start of the 20th century, a century that was so much visual and still is so visual today, that the Sacred Heart consecration and the appearance of the Shroud of Turin in its photographic form that went right around the world, is it a coincidence that all of this is happening at the same time? Okay, we'll leave it there. I'll leave you with that thought. We'll return to it tomorrow. When we come back, we are now going to be moving into the area of relics, and the Shroud of Turin may indeed be a relic. It's a rather controversial one. But after we come back, we'll be speaking to Sean Pilcher, who is a relic hunter extraordinaire. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Hello and welcome back to the Turley Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Now, have you ever thought about relics? We've just been talking about the Shroud of Turin, which may or may not be a relic. It hasn't been officially declared either way. Now, to be honest, it's not the sort of thing that gets much discussion in various sections of the church today. In fact, I have very rarely heard anybody discuss it. Part of the reason for that, certainly in this country, in the UK, is because there is a kind of a Protestant snobbery around relics. Somehow relics are a Catholic thing, but relics are linked vaguely or overtly with long since debunked medieval forgeries of one sort or another. Well, my next guest takes a decidedly different view. He is Sean Pilcher, director of SACRA, Relics of the Saints, which is an apostolate established to promote the veneration of sacred relics with religious communities, dioceses, and archives. And what they do is they identify, document, and authenticate, and even repair, I'm told, various relics. So it's a pleasure to discuss this with Sean, who joins me down the line this morning. Sean, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Good morning. How are you?
Now, Sean, I am going to play devil's advocate this morning with you, if that is okay,
Good.
I'm a big fan of relics like you, but there may be somebody in the audience who thinks, hey, relics, this is the 21st century. Why do we need relics?
Mm-hmm. Good. Yes. Well, the first thing I would say is that anytime there have been Christians in history, there have been relics. So relics are there are examples of relics in the Old Testament with things like the Ark of the Covenant or the Staff of Moses. There are examples when people are buried near the bones of holy people. This has kind of miraculous effects. And then, of course, in the New Testament, you have examples of people caring for things around the saints. You have people bringing handkerchiefs to St. Paul to touch, and then they bring them to the sick. You have the earliest Christians risking their lives to go collect the blood of the martyrs or the bones of the martyrs. So the first thing I would say is that anytime there have been authentic kind of apostolic Christians, there has always been a reverence for relics. And this isn't really surprising because grace builds on nature. And even just as human beings, we need physical reminders. We keep, you know, granddad's jacket or grandma's pearls, or we have things that are precious that maybe to other people would just be kind of an old object. But because we're part of the family, we have things that kind of remind us of those people. And as parts of the Christian family, the mystical body of Christ, of course we would have things that belong to or parts of our older brothers and sisters in the faith. It's really just grace building on that natural tendency we have.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Sean, and that's a very clear answer. And yes, you're right, the Bible is full of relics. And in fact, I came across something which really surprised me, because I've read it many times and not seen it, was that when the children of Israel left Egypt, they took the bones of Joseph with them.
That's right, yeah.
Which is so it's there, it's in Scripture. But listen, the church... So that's the sort of dismissal of some of the objections to relics. But let's define what a relic is, because a relic isn't just something I've decided to be a relic. I mean, there's a whole science and a theology around relics. And I know there's first class, second class, and even third class relics. I was offered a third class relic the other day. Talk to us a little bit about the church's understanding of relics in a very sort of precise, scientific way.
Sure, sure. So I would say the best definition of a relic is something that is a part of or something or a piece of a saint or something associated with a saint. So as you mentioned, there's these kinds of classes of relics, and that's a more recent thing. I mean, the Middle Ages wouldn't have known too much about classes of relics, but it's a helpful distinction to kind of know what we're talking about. So the first class of relic is really the relic most properly understood. It's a bone of a saint, or part of their hair, or even part of their flesh, you know, something that really is a piece of the saint. And this, again, goes back to the catacombs and celebrating Mass on the tombs of the martyrs. So we want to have that connection with the apostolic faith, with the earliest Christians. And so whenever there's Mass, there's bones of the martyrs underneath. And this is why most churches even have altar stones in them, which we can maybe say more about, but they're relics.
Let's just pause there, Sean, because that's a really important point. And I have to say, we had a Eucharistic procession in the local parish, and I had to put together one of the side altars again, which is wooden and sort of a bit makeshift, but we put it together. And then I saw this large stone being put into it, and I thought, aha, that's what I think it is. So just talk to us a little bit about, many people listening will be Catholic, have gone to their parish this morning, heard Mass. Tell us a little bit about that essence, where relics and the sacrifice of the Mass are inextricably linked in our altars.
Right, exactly. So the connection with the early church and the faith of the apostles, well, the way they celebrated Mass was over the bones of the martyrs. So every parish, every altar that's consecrated, when it's consecrated by a bishop, even now, part of that rite is that the bishop will take relics, usually of martyrs. We say usually around three martyrs is kind of the traditional practice, will be placed in the altar and then sealed there with sacred chrism and then eventually grout, you know, so that they stay in. And so if you see an altar that's maybe on Holy Thursday, when the altar has been cleared off of all the cloths and everything, you can see a marble stone. And there's little niche in the middle, and then five crosses, one on each corner and one in the middle, where the bishop will have anointed it or consecrated it when the church is consecrated. So every Catholic church, properly speaking, includes relics in its worship. And this is one of the reasons that even if the Blessed Sacrament isn't reserved at an altar, it's appropriate to bow to a side altar an altar that doesn't have the Blessed Sacrament, because we're bowing to the relics of the martyrs.
Absolutely. Can I just ask, Sean, is that on your average parish stone with the relics, would they be first class, second class, or third class?
So the relics in altar stones are always first class.
Wow.
Yep, so they're always bones of martyrs, and this is a common practice, especially before the Second Vatican Council, that a diocesan chantry would issue, you know, small fragments of Roman martyrs, say, from the catacombs, specifically for that purpose, for the consecration of churches.
Wow, and this tradition of praying over with the bones of the martyrs goes way back to the very, very beginnings of Christianity, right?
That's right. Yeah, the earliest church fathers mention actually very precious stories about, you know, we went in the night and recovered the body of St. Polycarp is one that's often cited. He's very early, first couple centuries. And, you know, they would go and risk their lives to go recover his bones and then bring them to a precious place. And here they are wrapped, you know, in purple and gold cloth. And they really are valued in a way that, you know, we would expect. Relics kind of give us pause, maybe, as you say, as modern Americans. But, you know, everybody wants to go see Elvis's guitar or, you know, a piece of the Berlin Wall or something that was part of the moon landing. You know, we're okay with that. But then as soon as you make it about our brothers and sisters in Christ, then we kind of go, whoa, you know, what is this? But really, it's just this human instinct, you know, sort of baptized and allowed.
We'll come back to that that very interesting segue that you mentioned there, Sean. But I did ask the question about the different classifications. So let's just recap what a first class relic is, and then we'll go second and third.
Absolutely. So the first class relic would be usually bones or hair or some piece actually of the saint. And that's, I think, the one that maybe gives people most pause. And we can talk about kind of why that's all right and why not cremation or something like that. And then the second class would be something that belonged to the saint. So you have the saint's rosary beads or part of the saint's breviary or part of their religious habit or, you know, part of their clothing or piece of furniture they had. So something kind of more closely associated with the saint. But still, you know, some part of them. And for some saints, this is the highest class possible because either they were martyred and the relics were never recovered or they were lost or something like this. And then the third class really is kind of more of a devotional practice. So the third class relic, you wouldn't see it so much in a church, like on display for veneration of the faithful. A third class relic is really more of a devotional practice of the faithful where they would take a piece of cloth or they would take a rosary or take their scapular, their wedding ring or some sacramental, and they would touch that to the first or the second class relic as kind of a reminder of the blessing they received and kind of a connection to that, again, that physical connection to the life of prayer. It's not just all kind of up in the air and angels and in my head, but it's really tangible. It's something I can hold on to in a time of distress or temptation and really have that visible link. So that's the third class relic.
I mean, when I was offered that third class relic of somebody whose cause is going ahead, I have to say I was slightly concerned about having it, not because I don't think it's worth having, but because I was worried I might lose it. I mean, is there, if I had a third class relic, Sean, and I lost it and it just disappeared, I mean, it doesn't stop being a third class relic, but does one need to have a certain degree of veneration, not just veneration, but almost guardianship over having some sort of relic of a holy person? It's not something that you can, oh, well, I lost that pair of rosary beads or whatever it is. Or am I being scrupulous?
No, I think there's a really healthy respect. I mean, there's the Blessed Sacrament, which is an entirely different sort of thing.
Yes.
But we see people caring for relics, especially, you know, in the early church and through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, with a kind of respect you might see, you know, like always kind of a keeping a remembrance of its presence and keeping it somewhere holy in the home. A lot of people have a place where they go with their family to pray, and that's where you keep it. You know, you wouldn't keep it, you know, in the drawer of the nightstand or whatever. You'd keep it there and venerate it. And a lot of people will kiss a relic. That's an appropriate way of venerating, or a bow. We usually reserve genuflecting just for relics of the true cross. That's kind of a special, because we don't want to confuse the relic with, say, like the Blessed Sacrament, which, of course, is our Lord. But you see people bow. You see people kiss them, touch them reverently. So there is a kind of deference, a kind of attention that they demand. And that's why, yeah, like you say, if you keep it in your home, it should be in a place of honor and a place of respect, not just kind of out and about.
Yes, it shouldn't be in an old drawer with a load of old documents or golf
right.
balls or something like that. It has to have its
right.
own sort of prominence. Well, this is very nice, Sean. You really sort of intrigued me. Now, we're going to go for a break in a moment. When we come back, I'm going to ask you a little bit about some very famous relics, but also your view on other things which are maybe more controversial when it comes to whether they're relics or not. You're listening to Sean Pilcher, who is the director of SECRA, the Relics of the Saints. And if you have any questions, maybe you've got a relic at home or somewhere and you're concerned about it or you want to ask advice about it, then you can do. You can phone us on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be back talking relics straight after these words. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I hope your Wednesday is going wonderfully well. Today we're talking relics, and I'm in conversation with Sean Pilcher, who is the director of SACRA, Relics of the Saints, which is an apostolate established to promote the veneration of sacred relics. Sean, how did SACRA come about?
Well, there are, as you might imagine, fewer and fewer people who are experts in relics, and it's a little bit of a lost art. There are probably only three or four people who do work like we do in the United States anymore, and I happen to live nearby someone who was kind of doing this work but retiring and getting a little along in years, and so actually, when I was a student at university, I would go and help this priest serve Mass and then ask him about the various relics. I was always kind of curious about them and have been a history person, and I speak Latin. So really, I didn't realize, but I was kind of a shoo-in for the job with this kind of knowledge. So I would kind of help out, and I would kind of apprentice, if you want to put it that way. And then I sort of, you know, moved on and was doing my own work and made sure to, you know, seek the approval of the various ecclesiastical authorities where I was doing it. But everyone's been very supportive and very grateful because, as you say, interest in relics is maybe at a low, and people are eager, I think, to learn about why we still have them and why it's still a thing that the church believes in. And because there's so few people, there's a lot of relic work to be done. I mean, really significant amounts of work to be done. So, it's great. It's great. I get to work with the saints and with people who want to get closer to the saints.
I mean, you say that there's not a lot of interest in relics, but is that partly because a lot of Catholics in particular have just never really understood what, you know, the nature of relics, what they are, that they are part and parcel of our faith in a sense?
That's right. I think any aversion people might have doesn't come from a place of ill will. I think it really is just maybe they haven't ever had it explained to them. It wasn't something mentioned in their RCIA class, or if it was, it was kind of glossed over. But as you say, I mean, anytime since the earliest Christian times, there have been relics, and anytime you have a church, there's relics there. And so they're an important visual connection to our doctrine of the saints, the communion of the saints, and the resurrection of the dead. And they're really a major part of the life of the church, especially historically. So I think when people learn about it and they understand kind of why they're important and given an opportunity to have an experience, a connection with the saint, that's something people really take with them, and I think it has an impact.
Just got a question for you here, Sean. How does one preserve a relic? I guess it depends on the relic, but maybe you could give us an example of a recent relic which you've helped preserve or repair or in some way help.
Sure. So one example would be I was helping a religious community with some relics of the saint that they're person or the saint that their community is named after. So they had a number of relics that were given a very long time ago when their religious community was founded, and they wanted to kind of sort of do some repairs, and this relic had been venerated by the sisters in this community for years and years and years and years, and the saint was somebody they revere, and so they sent me the relic, and I was able to do some kind of cleaning. You know, anything with glue needs repair after a while, after a few hundred years. So I was able to clean it up and repair and put it in a new reliquary. And all of this, of course, comes with documentation to ensure that there's kind of a line of continuity and we can be sure about the relic's authenticity.
That's right.
And then the sisters also asked, you know, could you, if you're while you're repairing, if there are a couple of smaller relics that are in the case, because it wasn't easily visible, could we put those in another small reliquary so that, you know, if there's a sister that's sick or that's having a rough time, we could, you know, she could borrow this relic for herself and have it for prayer and whatever. So that's a pretty common example of, you know, people have a relic and it needs repair, or the paperwork's been lost. We had one that was lost in a fire, you know, and I was able to kind of observe the various characteristics of the relic and use the history and sort of retroactively fill in some of the historical information. So I would say, how do you keep a relic? Well, you keep it reverently. And most of these first and second class relics are kept either in churches or in religious communities. But I would say some some lay people definitely would have them, you know, as,
yes.
as things passed down
yes.
in the family, or they went to Rome and Cardinal so-and-so gave them one or something, but always reverently.
Absolutely. Now, when you're doing that sort of restoration work, is there a set of prayers before you embark on that? I mean, it's not just something, oh, you take it to somebody who can fix it. You know, this is a sort of sacred, a holy act, right?
It is, yeah, yeah. I try to approach it with a spirit of prayer, and I always invoke the saints that I'm working on, you know, because they're there, they're right there with me, literally. The patron saint of relic work, or one of them anyway, is Saint Helena. Saint Helena was the mother
of course,
Emperor Constantine, and she, I imagine, had a great many things she could have been doing as the mother of the Byzantine emperor, or the Roman emperor, but she went to the Holy Land and recovered the relics, most notably of the Holy Cross that our Lord died on.
Absolutely.
But also a great many other relics related to the Passion, and she used her kind of royal influence to care for and recover the relics of the saints. So she is a great intercessor for me. I always ask Saint Helena to help me. And, you know, it's good to do it in a quiet place, in a clean environment, and, you know, light a blessed candle, that kind of thing.
Yes.
But really, it's a very, it's exhausting work, because oftentimes relics are very small, they're very old, they're fragile. And these are things, you know, if they're lost, you can't get more. You know, the other day I was working on a relic of the bones of Saint Andrew, the apostle. And, you know, if I sneeze, or I'm careless, or, you know, I try and remove something too quickly and it's lost, well, it's lost. There's no replacement for these things. So they're so precious, and the work is meticulous, but it's extraordinarily rewarding.
You know, the way you just said that, Sean, you were working on the bones of St. Andrew. I mean, I think I'd be a nervous wreck if I was working on the bones of St. Andrew, for the reasons you just identified, that
definitely.
The whole thing would fall apart. Got another couple of questions here for you, Sean. Can you sell a relic?
Oh, definitely no, definitely not. The sale of relics is explicitly forbidden in the church's law, in canon law. So relics are never to be sold. Sometimes if a religious community sends me a relic of theirs to work on, there's no exchange of cash. But if they want me to do some repair work or to do some research, this kind of thing is as I said, pretty meticulous work. And a lot of the times relic history can be pretty involved. So our apostolate charges money just for our time, basically, and our labor. But there's no, you know, you can't write us an email and make a donation and we'll mail you a relic. You know, that's
right.
Expressly forbidden by the church.
As the sale of any sacred thing. I mean, it's an ancient tradition. So there's another question here which leads on to a whole different discussion, Sean. But it asks, are there forgeries of relics?
Definitely. There have always been forgeries of relics for as long as there has been relics. But the internet has really been a game changer, because you have a lot of religious communities that have kind of changed their focus, let's say, in the latter half of the last century. And these communities are looking to get rid of their relics. So a lot of communities, unfortunately, have jettisoned them, and antique dealers come and pick them up and try to sell them, either because they don't know what they are or because they don't care that they're sacred objects. So you see real relics for sale sometimes, which is a great sadness. And then, of course, people think, you know, maybe I can take an old-looking case and put a chicken bone in here and slap some wax on there and kind of rough it up a little bit in the yard, and then I can call that a relic, you know, and sell it on eBay. And you have pious people who are thinking they're rescuing a relic, you know, bidding thousands and thousands of dollars on eBay or on auction sites. And so my advice to people would be never, ever, ever buy a relic. If you think you are, you know, if you're a pastor of a church or a mother superior somewhere and you think you see one, get in touch with us and we'll try and help you understand if the thing you're looking at is a real relic. But the sale of relics is always forbidden. And there are so many forgeries that it wouldn't be worth, you know, wasting one's money on just a forgery.
It must be sort of exciting, Sean, some of the work you're doing, because you remind me of some of the sort of art dealers and this sort of all the forgeries in the art world of famous old masters and what have you. I mean, is there a sort of tingle of excitement when you get an email or a letter or a call from somebody saying, I think I've got a relic here, and you're not quite sure who it is or where it's from or what it might be? Is that part of the – is it almost like a bit of a holy treasure hunt almost?
Yes, there's a temptation to a kind of Indiana Jones feeling for sure.
Yes,
but it's ultimately very rewarding because people are generally, I think, pretty good-willed, and you know, if a dealer has something that's a sacred object, sometimes I can kind of explain, or someone on our team can kind of explain the nature of it and sort of come to an understanding. Or if someone is, you know, in a bidding war on eBay, I can put their conscience at ease and say, you weren't bidding on a real thing, or stop bidding because this is fake. And it puts their conscience at ease. They're not obligated to go and save, as it were, something from the internet.
Now, I've got another question here for you, Sean. What has been some of the hardest relics of Saints to acquire? I guess he's saying what are the sort of top 10 relics out there that you know, everybody really wants one of? Presumably the True Cross, if there are still those relics around.
Definitely. Most of the large relics of the True Cross are kept. There are a few in the Holy Land. There are a few in major basilicas in Europe. A few in Rome.
Yeah.
A few actually in the United States. So I would say the Holy Cross is easily the most notable relic that people look for. You know, there's a temptation maybe sometimes for people to approach relics as it, like, if it were baseball cards or something, to have a collection. You know, oh, can you get me one of these or one of those? And really, relics are for public veneration and for people to have an experience of a saint. So, there, we want to avoid this kind of collector mentality, but the ones that are, I think, most difficult are just because of the natural scarcity of them. You know, people like the apostles, saints that are very popular, people that are widely venerated, like a Saint Therese or a John Paul II or Saint Anthony. You know, we had yesterday things that are saints that are well known and have a very widespread cult would be saints that people really look for.
Now, as many of our listeners will know, the process of canonization begins not when somebody is canonized, but they are blessed before that, then they're venerable, they're servant of God. Do you find that, I know, for example, of one case at the moment of somebody who's just been declared a servant of God and their cause has been opened. Is that the moment when there is a kind of a collecting of relics related to that individual?
That's right. So the process reaches a certain point. Sometimes it can be servant of God and sometimes it can be blessed, depending a little on the circumstances. Then what's called a recognitio happens. That's Latin for recognition or observing. And the bishop or his representative, the postulator of the saint's cause, some medical personnel, a relic person, someone like me or someone on our team would go and observe the opening of the saint's tomb. And that's when relics could either be gathered for preparation for churches or for faithful. And then there's kind of a observation done of what are the relics, what's the state of the body, et cetera. So we want to avoid, you know, we're not grave digging, we're not grave robbing, we're not opening willy-nilly and desecrating someone's grave. But the church, in her process of canonization, leaves room for people seeking miracles through saints' intercession, and part of that is the distribution of relics, so that if a sick person is seeking that person's intercession, they can have a relic next to them in the hospital or pray for a miracle, that kind of thing.
I don't suppose, I'm not asking you to break any professional confidences, Sean, but you haven't been called to Missouri in recent days to go out to a monastery out there where there's a lot of people who are talking about all sorts of strange and wonderful things?
Well, of course, that's a real example of relics in the modern day. Of course, the sisters' cause hasn't yet been opened, so there are only certain things that are allowed by the law
yes.
of the church. But you can see the natural tendency of the faithful. Here's a person who had a holy life, and there's some sign of extraordinary grace being poured out here. And I think whether the sister is incorrupt or not, the point is that people are learning about this wonderful person's life, and they're being drawn closer to God, and they're having an experience of prayer. And right in the middle of that is a person's body and her habit, which is itself a holy sacramental, and the religious life. I mean, these are all things that are not just doctrines in the ether or in a catechism. They're real, lived out, tangible things. And so I think even though the sister's cause hasn't been opened, it's a very good example of the faithful's universal tendency toward something tangible, which can help them live out their life of virtue.
And in some ways, relics are a direct sort of a way of understanding the kind of incarnational nature of our faith. Our faith is not some philosophy. It's about God made man, and also about the fact that all that is human is somehow brought into that realm. And relics are a very, very tangible way in which we can contact or be in contact with holiness, right?
That's right.
Also, I mean, relics are used often. I mean, I had a bad injury a few years ago, and relics were placed upon the limb that was injured. I mean, this is a common occurrence as well. Relics are used in that sort of healing essence, which, as you related, goes all the way back to the Acts of the Apostles.
That's right. Physical healing and also spiritual healing. I have never been to an exorcism. I imagine most lay people haven't, but priests who are exorcists will testify to the power of relics, both for spiritual healing, for physical healing, and for spiritual healing. And there are all kinds of wild, crazy stories about the people struggling under some kind of demonic influence being freed through the power of the saints.
Well, it's been very, very interesting, fascinating, in fact, speaking with you this morning, Sean. Can you tell people where they can find out more about your work? And also, if they have a relic or they don't know what to do with a relic, you would be the best person to contact. So let people know where they can contact you and find out more about your work.
That's right. Yeah. So we have a website, sacrarelics.org. Sacra is Latin for holy things. So sacra is S-A-C-R-A, sacra, relics. sacrarelics.org, and there's some information about who our team is and what kind of work we do. And yeah, if there are people who have relics in their home, or pastors or religious superiors that are looking to learn more about relics for their parish, things like that, people can get in touch. There's a way to send an email there. I should also mention there's a way to donate. As I said, we can't charge anybody for a relic. That would be sacrilegious. But a lot of the work we do in rescuing them from antique dealers, or for making sure they're authentic for people to venerate, takes a lot of time and energy. So if people like our work, they can make a donation there. The other thing is that people often have relics in their homes and their heirlooms, and they don't know what to do with them, and they don't know how to respect them. So if people are in that situation, feel free to write, and we have some information we can provide about that as well.
Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Hopefully you'll come back and talk to us soon. That was Sean Pilcher from Sacra Relics of the Saints. When we come back, we are going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Telefrequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.